Page 4 in your outlines, Isaiah chapter 52. Now, all of the key passages in Messianic Christology, this is by far has proven to be the most significant, the most detailed, as well as the most influential in bringing many Jewish people to faith. Now, exceptions, of course, and a friend of mine named Bear Leventhal, the key passage for him was the 77th of Daniel chapter 9, but for me and most of the Jewish believers, the key passage was the one we're going to be looking at tonight. But before we begin to go through a passage, I want to deal with some aspects of both the wider context and then the more immediate context. And the wider context begins, if you keep your finger here in chapter 52 and go all the way back to chapter 1. Chapter 1 of Isaiah, verse 4. Chapter 1, verse 4. Chapter 1, verse 4. Our sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, trodden the deal corruptly. They have forsaken Jehovah, they have despised the Holy One of Israel. They are estranged and gone backward. Why will ye still be stricken? Ye revolt more and more. The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot even unto the hip, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and fresh stripes. Just note these three words. Wounds, bruises, and fresh stripes. They have not been closed, neither have been bound up, neither mollified with oil. Your country is desolate, your cities are burned with fire, your land strangers devour it in your presence, and is desolate as overthrown by strangers. And the daughter of Zion is left as a booth in a vineyard, as a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. And notice that in this passage he pictures Israel as an individual, but a very sick individual. This was pictured here as being extremely spiritually sick. And there's three key passages, words which are used that I mentioned a few moments ago. Wounds, bruises, and stripes in verse 6. And now the servant of chapter 52 and 53 will come to take these bruises upon himself, these wounds, and comes to heal the nation. That's what he sets as a key problem for Israel in chapter 1, as a very spiritually sick nation. He will now show the resolution and solution to that problem in Isaiah chapter 52 and 53. What also has been developing within this book prior to getting to the key passage is been developing two themes, two parallel themes. Not putting them together quite yet, but two parallel themes. The first parallel theme is one we've been developing as of last night, and that is the servant of Jehovah motif. As we noted in chapter 42, verses 1 through 6, the mission of the servant. And we saw in chapter 49, verses 1 through 13, that the mission of the servant is accompanied with many difficulties, because in verses 1 through 4, the servant is rejected by Israel. And in verses 5 through 7, he will then become a light to the Gentiles. But in verses 8 through 13, eventually Israel will be accept the Messiah and be restored. And then we saw in chapter 50, verses 4 through 9, that a servant suffers a great deal of physical abuse, though no specific reason had been given for the abuse so far. And now in chapter 52 and 53, we shall see both the reason for the suffering, and furthermore, we'll be told something we're not told in chapter 15, his physical sufferings will lead to his death. And so he's been developing one motif, so far that we've been looking at. The second motif we have not been developing, but it's also found here, is the motif of the arm of Jehovah, the arm of the Lord. Let's look at some examples beginning in chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40, and look at verse 10. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 10. Behold, the Lord Jehovah will come as a mighty one, and his arm will rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him and his recompense before him. And the point is that the arm of Jehovah will rule on behalf of God. Look at chapter 51. Chapter 51, verse 5. Chapter 51, verse 5. My righteousness is near, my salvation is gone forth, and mine arms shall judge the peoples, and the isles shall wait for me. On mine arm shall they trust. And the point of 51:5 is that the Gentiles will put their trust in the arm of the Lord. And then in verse 9 he says, awake, awake, put on your strength, O arm of Jehovah, awake in the days of old, the generations of ancient times. Is it not you that did cut Rahab in pieces and did pierce the monster? And the point of verse 9 is that the arm will be the Redeemer, and the arm of Jehovah will come to redeem. And now go to chapter 52, verse 10. Chapter 52, verse 10. Jehovah will bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth have seen the salvation of our God. And here he points out verse 10 that the arm will provide salvation. The arm of Jehovah will provide salvation. And we get to a main messianic passage from chapter 52, verse 13 through chapter 53, verse 12. He'll finally put the servant and the arm together. So in chapter 52, verse 13, behold my servant. And in chapter 53, verse 1, who had believed our message and to whom had the arm of Jehovah been revealed? And now he clearly identified the arm of Jehovah and the servant to be one and the same. So in the wider context, he's not going to bring these two parallel elements together. In the immediate context, look at chapter 52, verse 3. Chapter 52, verse 3. For thus says Jehovah, you were sold for nothing, you shall be redeemed without money. You shall be redeemed without money. And now he'll spell out exactly what the redemption price will be. It won't be money, it'll be the blood of the messianic servant. As far as the prophetic setting of this prophecy, this is a prophecy we'll see clearly both the death of the Messiah, the burial of the Messiah, and even clearly bringing out, and not quite as directly, but still clear enough, the resurrection of the Messiah. But as you read chapter 53, verses 1 through 9, chapter 53, verses 1 through 9, what you will notice is that this is Israel confessing the failure to recognize him when he first came. And we shall see when he was first here, they thought he was suffering for his own sins. Only now, finally, do they become conscious that he was suffering for their sins. And what we know from the overall picture of Bible prophecy is that the prerequisite to the second coming is Israel's national salvation. One of the distinctives between the rapture of the church and the second coming is the rapture has no preconditions. It can happen in a moment of time. But the actual second coming does have one key precondition. That's Israel's national salvation. Israel must confess the failure to recognize him. And that's the confession they will someday recite, the confession of chapter 53, verses 1 through 9. That's the specific prophetic background. So that once they confess their failure to recognize him and come to him, then chapter 54, they'll finally enter the Messianic kingdom. Now, as far as the key question dealing with the Jewish community is, who is this speaking of? Because the dominant Jewish view today is that this servant represents not one individual, represents corporately the Jewish people. And so what he's describing here is that this is the sufferings of Israel scattered among the Gentiles. And what you often hear with rabbis today is that while the Christian view is that this passage speaks about the Messiah, the Jewish view is that this represents Israel. What the rabbis do not bring out is that this is a relatively new position in Jewish history. We have tons of Jewish literature dating from the time before Jesus came and for the centuries afterwards. And there was uniformity as to how they interpret the passage. And all ancient Jewish writings clearly took this to be speaking of the Messiah and not of Israel. This goes back to pre-times of Jesus, also goes back to the Talmudic period, the post-Talmudic period and so on. In fact, the first person to give this nationalistic interpretation was Rabbi living around 1050 AD, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, referred to simply as Rashi, R-A-S-H-I, and he was the first person in 1050 AD to label this passage as speaking of Israel suffering among the Gentiles. And Rashi had to contend with many debates with Christian leaders, and this was his way out of the dilemma. But even in his day, when he took this view, it was a very minority view, most Jewish rabbis of his time and even after his time rejected that view. So, example, one rabbi writing in the year 1350, about three centuries after Rashi, says this: "I am pleased to interpret in accordance with of our rabbis of the King Messiah. It will be careful as far as I am able to adhere to the literal sense. Thus possibly I shall be free from the fancied and far-fetched interpretations of which others have been guilty," as referring to the interpretation this passage refers to Israel. He says that is far-fetched and fancied interpretation. In fact, it was only in the mid-1800s that finally became the dominant view of the Jewish community. Only in the mid-1800s. And that was only a reaction to the way this passage was being used by people witnessing the Jewish people, because in the mid-1800s is when the ghetto walls began to break down. Jews were free to live, to move out of the ghettos and begin to live in the wider society, and began to run into evangelical believers who often used this passage to convince them that Jesus had to be the Messiah, and were quite successful. As a result, the rabbis reacted by making Rashi's view the dominant view, as remained the dominant view in the Jewish society to this very day. But this is speaking of the Messiah, not Israel, has been the primary Jewish view for over a millennium. It's not the only line of evidence. There's several other evidences. The second line of evidence is the distinctive pronouns we'll see in this passage. We'll see a contrast between the plural pronouns and the singular. On the plural side, there was we, us, and our. And the singular side, there was he, him, and his. Now, who are the we, us, and our? Well, in this context, the we, us, and our has to be Isaiah and his listeners, and he had a Jewish audience, not a Gentile audience. And if we, us, now refers to Isaiah and Israel, then the singular pronouns, he, him, and his, must refer to the Messiah. A third line of evidence is that the servant throughout this passage is portrayed as a singular human personality. There's no indication that he represents the nation. That was true in chapter 1, where the nation was represented as one sick individual. And he even told us that the man represents Israel, but that does not happen in this passage. In this passage, the servant is one singular being. There's no allegory and no personification of Israel. A fourth thing to note is what he says in verse 7, chapter 53, verse 7, the servant suffers a voluntary, willing, and silent death. His suffering is voluntary, willing, and he remains silent. This has not been true with Israel, that has constantly avoided protest against their sufferings. We also see in verse 8, the fifth line of evidence, where the servant dies on behalf of my people. The servant dies on behalf of my people, but who are the my people? The my people have to be the Jewish people, and the servant is distinguished from my people, distinguished from the people of Israel. A sixth line of evidence we shall see is the servant is an innocent sufferer. In verses 4, 5, 6, 8, and 9, 4, 5, 6, 8, and 9, Israel has always suffered for its own sins and not because of innocency. In fact, one of the differences between Israel and the church lies right here. God told Israel, if you will be righteous, if you will obey the law, you will not suffer persecution. But if you're disobedient, you will suffer persecution. The fact that Israel suffers is due to Israel's sins. But for the church, he says, in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 12, for example, if you live godly lives, you will attract persecution. So the Israel, if they were godly, they would not suffer persecution. For us, if we do live godly, we will suffer persecution, because living godly puts condemnation upon the unbeliever. The seventh line of evidence that this is speaking of the Messiah is that the servant suffers a vicarious and substitutionary death. This will come out several times in verses 4, 5, 6, 8, 10, 12, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10, 12. The servant suffers a vicarious and substitutionary death. Israel does not suffer on behalf of the Gentiles. Israel suffers because of the Gentiles, but not on their behalf. Now, the eighth line of evidence we shall see is that the sufferings of the servant bring justification and spiritual healing to those who accept it. Again, the sufferings of the servant bring justification and spiritual healing to those that accept it. A point he makes in verse 5 and verse 11. 5 and 11, Israel has not done this for the Gentiles. The ninth evidence is that the servant will die. In verse 8 and verse 12, the servant dies, but Israel always survives its periods of persecution. And finally, number 10, the servant is resurrected, as we'll see in verse 10 and verse 11. Israel never died, so never needed to be resurrected. The Jewish people have always been around with their identity. Looking at the outline on page 4, the way the structure of this passage is, it has five stanzas. Each stanza has three verses. Five stanzas. Each stanza has three verses. And the first line of each stanza is the theme of the whole stanza. The first line is the theme of the stanza. So I've given you the first line on your outline of each of these stanzas. The basic breakup is that in chapter 52, verses 13 through 15, God introduces his servant, and the Hebrew text uses mixed tenses. The tenses are mixed. In chapter 53, verses 1 through 9, we have Israel's confession of the failure to recognize him. Here all the tenses in Hebrew are perfect tenses, perfect tenses. And finally, in verses 10 through 12, chapter 53, verses 10 through 12, we have the theology of the suffering servant, and again, the tenses are mixed. So point one, your outline, behold, my servant shall prosper, in verses 13 through 15, behold, my servant shall prosper, deal wisely, she shall be exalted, and lifted up, and shall be very high. Like as many as were astonished at you, his visage was so marred, more than any man, his form more than the sons of men. So shall he sprinkle many nations, kings shall shut their mouths at him. For that which had not been told, they shall see, and that which they had not heard, shall they understand. So it begins with the first stanza, behold, my servant shall prosper, or shall deal wisely. And in verse 13, he focuses on the exaltation of the servant. And he begins with the word, behold, calling special attention to this individual. And Hebrew word can mean either to deal wisely, or could mean to prosper. Same word can mean either thing. And both statements ultimately true. He will deal wisely or prudently. He'll act with intelligence. He'll be successful. The same word is used in Jeremiah chapter 23, verse 5. 23 verse 5 also with a messianic context. And then he adds, he shall be exalted. It's a Hebrew word that means to rise, often used of rising from the dead, not exclusively, but often used that way. But in this context, it will be a reference to the resurrection. It says he shall be lifted up, a reference to the ascension, and he shall be exceedingly high, a reference to his present session in heaven at the right hand of God the Father. We could summarize verse 13 in this manner. The servant will act wisely or prosper, and his actions will gain him a position of glory. The servant will act wisely or prosper, and his actions will gain him a position of glory. But before he comes to the exaltation of verse 13, he must undergo a humiliation in verse 14. Like as many as were astonished at you. And why were they astonished? Because his visage was so marred, the rather strong Hebrew word, to be so disfigured, he no longer resembled a man. He was so disfigured, he no longer resembled a man. And the point of verse 14, the summary is that he will suffer such terrible abuse physically that he'll be disfigured. And this verse was essentially fulfilled by the Roman scourge. Now, in the first century context, there were two types of scourges practiced. There was a Jewish scourge, the Roman scourge. The Jewish scourge was called 40-save-1, 40-save-1. And that was based upon the principle of the Mosaic law that you could not whip anyone over 40 lashes. And in keeping with the rabbinic concept of building a fence around the Torah, fence around the law, the issue came up, suppose the lasher is lashing and miscounts, and gives the victim 41 lashes and break the law. And so to protect the law, they said they will stop the count at 39. And the Jewish scourge was made of a wooden handle or leather handle with short leather strands. The only part of a person's body that was affected was his back. And while it was very painful, it was never deadly. And Paul testifies he suffered the Jewish scourge 5 different times. That's not true with Jesus. He suffered the Roman scourge, which was far more severe. There are no limitations as to how many lashes one could receive. And furthermore, the Roman scourge had a handle of wood or leather, but the strands were very long, wrapping around the whole body. At the end of each leather strand was a piece of metal, glass, lamb bone, or nail. So after a few lashes, the skin was torn away. After some more, a piece of muscle would go flying. And the whole body was affected, the front, back, sides, and also the face was totally become pulpy. And in other descriptions we have, sometimes the face was so disfigured that they could not, even family members could not recognize the victim anymore. And so by means of Roman scourge, he was terribly disfigured, so marred, so disfigured, no longer resembled a man. One of the misconceptions we can get from crucifixion and paintings is they show Jesus with his face intact except for the crown of thorns, but that would not be the case after a Roman scourge. And many never survived the Roman scourge. Moving on to verse 15, he describes the victory of the servant. So shall he sprinkle or startle. Again, this Hebrew word can mean either to sprinkle or to startle many nations. And they will shut their mouths of him, shut their mouths as a sign of respect. And why? Because they shall see what they had not been told, they shall understand what they had not heard. This verse, by the way, is quoted in Romans chapter 15, verse 21. Romans 15, verse 21. We can summarize the verse as teaching the servant's sufferings will eventually gain the silent attention of the world rulers when they begin to understand the purpose of his sufferings. So these three verses, in the first stanza, God introduces the servant, pointing to his exaltation that was preceded with the humiliation, will end up someday in final victory among the nations. But now in stanzas 2, 3, and 4, he will now begin to move into Israel's confession of their failure to recognize him. And the second stanza comprises chapter 53, verses 1 through 3, who has believed our message. Who has believed our message, whom at the arm of Jehovah been revealed? For he grew up before him as a tender plant, as a root out of dry ground. He had no form nor comeliness. And when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected of men. He was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, as one from whom men hide their face. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. In verse 1, he focuses on Israel's unbelief. Who had believed our message or our hearing? They had heard the report of him, They've heard about him, but for a long time they simply refused to believe on him. And yet now they discover that he is the arm of Jehovah and the arm that brings salvation in the earlier parts of Isaiah. It's a verse that's quoted in John chapter 12, verses 37 and 38. John 12, 37 and 38, where John points out their unbelief. It's also quoted in Romans 10, verse 16. Romans 10, 16. So we have in verse 1 to summarize this, will now express a surprise at what they had or has just been stated in verses 13 to 15. They now finally come to recognize the one they heard about, the one they failed to believe in, is indeed the messianic person, the arm of Jehovah. In verse 2, he gives us the humanity of the servant. He grew up before him as a tender plant, a suckling. It's a tender twig that grows on the trunk of a branch and draws life from it, and people sometimes will cut off these sucklings because they draw life from the tree. And they viewed him as a suckling, simply drawing life out of the nation. He was a root out of dry ground, emphasizing his lowly condition, and the servant appears only when the house of David has been reduced to a poverty level. This was already prophesied, as we saw back in chapter 11, verse 1. And now in this verse, he carries on that thread further. He was born in a very lowly condition, poverty-stricken, and the house of David has lost all of its preeminence. Then he adds, he had no form nor comeliness. That's a terminology that means he had no outward physical beauty. He had no outward physical beauty. When we see him, there's no beauty in him that we should desire him. Nothing about his outward features would have attracted him. Many people would not have come to him because of how he looked like. Now, one of the reasons I don't particularly like pictures of Jesus is because most paintings I've seen him portrayed as, he looks like a handsome Scandinavian, and not like a Middle East Jew that he was. And he looks and makes him look rather good-looking. But actually, in reality, biblically, he was not particularly good-looking. What attracted people to him was not what he looked like, but what he taught and what he did. And if you focus on your favorite picture of Jesus and finally get to heaven, you might spend several centuries looking for him but can't find him because he does not look like the picture you had on your wall. And so to summarize this verse, this will now confess us that when the seven was with them, they didn't note any special things about his outward appearance that would attract them to him. And his childhood and growth was no different than those of others. Then in verse 3, they point out that he was despised. He was despised and rejected of men. The Hebrew word for men here means men of rank. He was especially rejected by the leaders of Israel. A man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, more literally a man of pains, and more knowledgeable of diseases, and therefore one who dealt with these things. And then they add, as one from whom men hide their face. Not only did he not attract other people to himself, many people were repulsed by him. He was despised, repeating the line again. And he says, we esteemed him not. We paid him no respect. Now, and his Hebrew name is Yeshua with four Hebrew letters, but the rabbis have shortened his name to three letters and do not call him Yeshua, but Yeshum. And Yeshum stands as an acronym for a Hebrew phrase meaning, may his name and memory be blotted out. May his name and memory be blotted out. And that's why they shorten his name that way. They also call him Hatalui, meaning the hanged one, which in the context of the Mosaic law was especially cursed situation. So summarize verse 3, on the contrary, he was despised and rejected, and people in general did their best to avoid him. Now we come to a third stanza. In verses 4 to 6, surely he had borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Picking up in verse 4, surely he had borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray, we have turned everyone to his own way, and Jehovah laid on him the iniquity of us all. Now verse 4 focuses on his substitutionary suffering, and notice the difference between the suffering servant and the plural pronouns. Surely he has borne our griefs, carried our sorrows, and that refers to Israel, and his sufferings were substitutionary. And the Hebrew word emphasizes our sicknesses. The Hebrew word used 22 times. It refers sometimes to different 8 ailments of the body, but also used as spiritual sickness. In light of chapter 1 of Isaiah, he's focusing here on the spiritual healing of the people and the nation. It says he also bore our pains, and the word for bearing is used in the Mosaic law of offering a sacrifice. In fact, it's used specifically of offering the Day of Atonement sacrifice in Leviticus chapter 16, verse 22, Leviticus 16, 22. They respond, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. He was and the Hebrew word means to be stricken with a hateful disease. Stricken with a shocking and hateful disease, and they viewed him as being stricken that way. And in fact, the rabbis used this verse to teach that the Messiah will be stricken with leprosy, because that's the word often used of leprosy in the Old Testament. But it's also used of spiritual sicknesses. So he bears upon himself the spiritual sickness of Israel, the spiritual sickness you already described back in chapter 1. But they point out they thought he was being smitten of God. They thought he was being stricken because of his own sins. And he was afflicted by God. And so Israel considered him to be suffering for his own sins, and his suffering was a punishment from God. And so the name they have for him in Hebrew is HaPosheya, the transgressor. And one rabbi even says he deserved this violent death. Now again, back in chapter 1, verses 4 through 8, Israel, the nation, was viewed as being spiritually sick. But now the servant takes on the sickness upon himself. And this verse is quoted in Matthew chapter 8, verse 17. Matthew 8, 17. And to summarize this verse, the nation who formerly despised the servant now recognizes he suffered vicariously as a substitute. They thought he was suffering for his own sins, but now realize he was suffering for their sins. In verse 5, he deals with a substitutionary death. He was wounded for our transgression. The Hebrew word is much stronger than English implies. The Hebrew word means to pierce through. And it's a word that is always used of a violent death, to be pierced through. He was pierced through because of our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities, but again, the word bruised does not capture the Hebrew wording. It means to be crushed. He was crushed for our iniquities. And the chastisement of our peace was upon him. The punishment that will lead to peace was upon him. And now they recognize with his stripes we are healed. The stripes of chapter 1 are now placed upon him. And this the word that is used here would refer to the stripes or the tumors raised on the skin because of the scourging. So summarizing verse 5, the nation confesses that the substitutionary sufferings resulted in reconciliation and spiritual healing because he was the chastisement for their sins. And now they recognize their own condition in verse 6, all we, like sheep, have gone astray, all we have turned away, all we have turned away went his own way, and you laid upon him the iniquity of us all, and that shows the necessity for the sufferings. The necessity for the sufferings. And so to summarize this verse, Israel now confesses that it was they who sinned and went astray, and God laid the iniquity of Israel upon the servant, and therefore he suffered. Now we come to a fourth stanza in verses 7 to 9. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet opened not his mouth. He was oppressed, yet when he was afflicted, opened not his mouth, as a lamb that is led to slaughter, as a sheep that before cherubs is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation, who among them considered that he was cut off out of land living, for the transgression of my people, to whom the stroke was due? And he made his grave with the wicked, and with the rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, neither was there any deceit in his mouth. Now, in these three verses, he points out the death and the burial of the Messiah. So, verse 7, he first speaks of the silence of the servant in his sufferings. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, but he opened not his mouth. As a lamb that left the slaughter, as a sheep that is dumb before its shearers, he opened not his mouth. A passage quoted in Acts chapter 8, verse 32, Acts 8:32. And the point of verse 7, to summarize, goes like this. The servant humbly subjected himself to suffering and unjust treatment, saying nothing in his own defense, and never complained. Now verse 8 deals with both his trial and his death. From prison and judgment he was taken away. And the Hebrew word for judgment means a judicial judgment. He underwent a specific trial. As for his generation, the Jewish generation of his day, who among them considered this cut off outer land of the living? And Matthew's special theme in his gospel is that the generation of Jesus' day is guilty of rejecting him. The generation of Jesus' day is guilty of the unpardonable sin. And what they felt and what that generation failed to realize, he was cut off out land of the living for the transgression of my people. And the phrase cut off is the common term used throughout the Mosaic law. It means to die a judicial death. To die a judicial death. It refers to a cutting off in a legal sense of the punishment of the law. But so the transgression of my people, who are the my people? The my people in this context only be Israel. And that's why the servant cannot be Israel. He's distinguished from Israel in this verse rather clearly. And it was upon my people the stroke was due. In other words, the stroke should have fallen on Israel, but in place, in substitution, it fell upon the servant. And this verse is quoted in Acts chapter 8, verse 33. So summarize this passage, this verse. After a judicial trial and judgment, the servant was taken away for execution, and no one realized he was dying for the sins of Israel. Well, Paul defines the gospel, what we have to believe to be saved, in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 1 through 4. 1 Corinthians 15, verses 1 through 4, he points out we must believe three things. Number one, he died for our sins. He died for our sins. And that point is now made explicit here in verse 8. He died for the transgression of my people. That's the first point of the gospel. Now, in verse 9, he deals with the burial of the servant. He made his grave with the wicked. He died as a criminal. He died a criminal's death. It was assigned the criminal's burial. But he says, well, rich man is dead. Nevertheless, he was buried in a rich man's tomb. Although he had done no violence, he was not guilty of any outward sin. No deceit in his mouth. There was no inward sin. And so we can summarize verse 9 in this teaching. The servant was assigned a criminal's grave, but in poetic justice, he was buried in a rich man's tomb. And the second point of the gospel is, and he was buried, which was the evidence of his death. And notice here we have the second point of the gospel. He was buried in a rich man's tomb. And now we come to a fifth stanza. In verses 10 through 12, you know, please Jehovah to bruise him, he had put him to grief. In verses 10 through 12, yet it pleased Jehovah to bruise him, he put him to grief. When you shall make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of Jehovah shall prosper in his hand. He shall see of the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. By knowledge of himself shall my righteous servant justify many, he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I will divide him a portion with the great. He shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul unto death. He was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bare the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. In verse 10, we're now told that God the Father will make the death of the servant an offering for sin. So it says, yet it pleased Jehovah to bruise him. It was the will of God the Father for the servant to die. It was necessary for him to die because atonement comes only by the shedding of blood. So God was pleased to bruise him, again more correctly, pleased to crush him, and God put him to grief. And the Hebrew word here means God, again, to means to disease. God diseased him. It's a good verse to show he's not talking about physical diseases, because the Messiah did not die of a physical disease. He died because of a spiritual disease when he took upon himself the sins of the world. And because, so he died of a spiritual sickness, so he's dealing with spiritual healing here. And then he says, when you shall make a soul offering for sin, this was the purpose of his death. And the word that is used for sin actually refers to the trespass offering. There was a sin offering and a trespass offering. The sin offering was for inadvertent sin, and the trespass offering was for deliberate sin. And so his death covers both deliberate sin and inadvertent sin. And he says, he shall see his seed. His seed are those who benefit from the benefit from his death by spiritual rebirth. But he will see his seed. Here you have the indication of a resurrection, which is not quite as clearly stated, but it's hard to escape. Because in verse 8 he was killed, in verse 9 he was buried, and now in verse 10 his life as his death is made an offering for sin. So how shall he see his seed if he's dead? That's only possible if he's resurrected from the dead, which brings in the third point of the gospel, he rose again. He says he shall prolong his days. How can he prolong his days if he was dead and buried? He prolongs it by resurrection. And because of his resurrection, he says, the pleasure of Jehovah shall prosper in his hand. And so his mission was not a failure, as might appear. It was a rising success. We'll summarize verse 10 in this manner. God was pleased to allow the servant to suffer and die, because this was the means by which God was going to make the atonement for the people. And though he dies, he will see his posterity, and his days will be prolonged. In verse 11, he focuses on the justification. He shall see of the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. Again, notice he shall see. How can he see? Except by virtue of his resurrection. And the point of verse 11 is that God will be satisfied with the death of the servant, and his sin offering, trespass offering, will be accepted. And by knowledge of himself shall my righteous servant justify many. The Hebrew can be taken in two different ways. One way to take it is by the knowledge of himself. And because he knows who he is, he can bring about justification. A second way to take it is by the knowledge of him. And this is experiential knowledge. By knowledge of him shall people be justified. Now both statements are true, and the Hebrew can go either way. Either way, justification comes to those that have an experiential knowledge of the Messianic servant, and he will bear their iniquities. And summarizing verse 11, God will be satisfied with the work of his servant. He dies a substitutionary death for his people, and by his death justifies many, and he bears their iniquity. Notice the word bearing iniquity. In dealing with the Day of Atonement sacrifice, two goats were presented before the high priest, and one goat was chosen to live, and one goat was chosen to die. The goat chosen to die would be killed by the altar, and the blood taken through the Holy of Holies and sprinkled upon the mercy seat, which was the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. And then the high priest came out, and he would lay his hands upon the live goat. As he laid his hands upon the live goat, the goat began speaking in tongues. Now scratch that. Just checking if you're awake. In the Old Testament, laying on of hands was a means of identification. And the second goat was not identified with Israel, and then he bore the sins of Israel outside the camp. The second goat would bear the sins of Israel outside the camp. So in verse 10, we have the fulfillment of the first goat. And in verse 11, also see again in verse 12, the fulfillment of the second goat of the Day of Atonement. So verse 12, we have the servant rewarded. Therefore I will divide him a portion with the great, and he will divide the spoil with the strong. Because the servant did what he did, the seed that has been justified by putting their faith in him, and those who believe on him in this age, in this dispensation, will receive the rewards of the kingdom, the next one. And that's for four reasons. Number one, he brought his soul unto death. Secondly, he was numbered with the transgressors. Thirdly, he bore the sin of many. And fourthly, he made intercession for the transgressors. This verse is quoted in Luke chapter 22, verse 37. Luke 22, verse 37. They summarize verse 12 in this way. The servant will be greatly blessed in the end above all others, because he died on behalf of others, and thus bore their sin and now intercedes for them. Now, we can summarize all that is taught here about the Messiah in nine basic points. Number one, the Messiah will be born in natural surroundings without any outward special characteristics. He'll be born in natural surroundings without any outward special characteristics. Secondly, the Messiah's first coming will be characterized by suffering. Thirdly, Messiah's first coming will be rejected. Fourthly, Messiah will undergo a legal trial and be condemned to death. And fifthly, will then be executed. A legal execution. Sixth, the Messiah will be buried in a rich man's tomb. And seventh, he will then be resurrected from the dead. He'll be raised from the dead. Eighth, all of Messiah's sufferings are substitutionary, and his death will also be substitutionary. And so ninth, the Messiah will bring justification to many. Okay, we'll take one more segment to finish Isaiah. Turn now to Isaiah chapter 61. This is the last of Isaiah's seven passages. And I mentioned that the one of the four categories of messianic prophecies are those that deal with both the first and second coming without implying there's a gap of time between the two comings. This is one such passage. And the first coming is in verse 1 in the first part of verse 2. He says, the Spirit of the Lord Jehovah is upon me. And no three persons here, the Spirit, Jehovah, and the Speaker. One of the Old Testament implications of a Trinity. The Holy Spirit, the Lord Jehovah, and the me, which is the Son. But now the servant speaker says, Jehovah had anointed me, as the meaning of the word Mashiach or Messiah, to be anointed. He was Messiah for five reasons. Number one, to preach good tidings unto the meek. And the word gospel means good news or good tidings. Secondly, to bind up the broken heart. And this would be a result of sin, inward results that require spiritual healing. Thirdly, to proclaim liberty to captives. This is outward problems of being enslaved to sin. Fourthly, the opening of the prison to them that are bound. And the Hebrew word means to have a wide open gate, freeing people from servitude to Satan. And fifthly, to proclaim the year of Jehovah's favor, announcing the new age of grace. Now, this is the section of Isaiah that Jesus read when he came back to his own synagogue in Nazareth. Now, there are certain rules to follow in the synagogue about reading of Scripture. And reading the prophets, you must read a minimum of three verses. But everybody is surprised he read only half the amount. He read verse 1, only the first part of verse 2. Then he stopped. Everybody was staring at him, and as we made the announcement, today is this scripture fulfilled in your ears. This is Luke chapter 4, verses 16 to 21. And the reason he stopped where he did is this is as much as he will fulfill in terms of his first coming. And the second part of verse 2 and verse 2 will be fulfilled only in connection with the second coming. But for Messianic Christology, there are two main points here. First of all, the Messiah will be anointed by the Holy Spirit. Which shall occur at his baptism. A Messiah will have a prophetic and preaching ministry. Have a prophetic and preaching ministry. What I want to do tomorrow night is finish the prophets. We'll probably begin the writings, maybe even do the writings up until Daniel. We won't quite make it through Daniel. So Wednesday we'll be able to do Daniel and also do some of the other things that you outlined. My goal was to get only as far as Roman numeral 3, the middle of page 6. But if time allows, we'll do some more of what's on the rest of page 6 and page 7. So again, let me encourage you to read all of these passages in advance and be better prepared for the study. Let me also remind you that if you want to sign up for any of the books or tapes or manuscripts or MP3s or DVDs, there'll be there's the back tables, a copy of each of these things for you to look at. And there'll be a lady there manning the table, or a woman in the table, I guess. And she will be able to give you the information out of all of the material. Just to give you a synopsis, the book that is relevant to our covering this week is what I mentioned last night, Messianic Christology. It covers all of these things you have in your outline. It also has a lot more in the book than I have time to cover here. Another book relevant to that one is called Jesus Was a Jew, in response to some rabbinic arguments against the Messiahship of Jesus. Plus, you like Bible prophecy, and there's a book called The Footsteps of the Messiah, and it covers all of the prophecies of Scripture and puts them in chronological sequence. You can tell what order these prophecies will be fulfilled. Also, the process of putting out a Messianic commentary in the whole Bible. Two volumes are out already. One covers Judges and Ruth. The one covers the Messianic epistles of Hebrews, James, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, Jude. The third volume is Genesis. It should be out sometime next month, or this month actually. By the end of this month, it should be made available. And on the envelope, you can also order that book if you like as well. They'll be about to, a little bit later before it's sent to you. Another book there is a literal interpretation of the Song of Solomon. So we named it Biblical Lovemaking for that reason. But it has only words, no pictures. And we have a book dealing with the Messianic movement and Hebrew Christianity. We also have a guidebook for Israel. I put that together for those who participate in our five-week study tours of Israel. And it covers every place in Israel in alphabetical order and tells you what happened there from biblical to modern times. We have a Life of Christ DVD that covers the 26th long version of this course, that you can also get all the details that way. And there's some other material there as well, and so on. So if you're ordering these things, just fill out the envelope and give it back to the lady manning the table, and then I'll mail all of these orders to the office on Thursday, and they'll begin to fill it in very quickly, so we can make use of that. If you're interested in participating in our special long study tours of Israel, our next trip will go for 1 month, leaving May 31. We'll be 3.5 weeks in Israel and then 4 days in Jordan, spending a full day in Petra. If you want to come on one of our special study tours, the information sheets are on the table. Just help yourself to one, and if you wish to sign up, please do so. And also, the information folders on the Kiyam Shoshana are also there, so please make use of that as well. All right, we'll follow the same procedure we did last night. We'll have an offering for our ministries, followed by a song. If you need to leave, that would be a good time to slip out. If you want to stay, we'll have a question and answer session as soon as the song ends. Again, your questions do not need to be limited. We've covered yesterday or today. You're welcome to ask questions in any areas of biblical studies, of Jewish studies, prophetic studies. The only question I won't answer is if it's a question I'll be dealing with tomorrow or Wednesday. I'll ask you to wait till then to get your answer, but otherwise there are no limitations. So, who's got the first question? American Standard Version, ASV of 1901. Question? Well, the word many by itself may or may not apply to Gentiles. Isaiah makes it clear that he'll justify Gentiles in chapter 42, verse 1 and verse 6, and chapter 49, verses 5 and 6. So the many might mean only the many of Israel. So that may be just an open door, but in Isaiah 62, verse 1 and verse 6, and Isaiah 49, verse 5 and 6, he explicitly states, the Messiah will be the light of the Gentiles. Question? Yeah? Right. Again, he's not been talking about physical healing anywhere in this context. In the background of this chapter 1, we picture Israel as being a spiritually sick nation. The fact he's not dealing with physical is because the Hebrew word used in verse 10 says, you disease him. It says he died by a disease, but he didn't die because of a physical disease. He died only because of a spiritual disease, human sin. So if you look at what he says about him, it's impossible for it to be physical healing. Physical healing is in the atonement only in the sense that there is a promise of resurrection. It is those who believe be raised from the dead, but doesn't guarantee physical healing in this life. Not that God won't heal people with prayers and so on. That's not a guarantee, it's not a promise. And if it guaranteed physical healing, this was part of the atonement, that means the moment you believe, you should have been physically healed of everything. And that doesn't happen. And those who teach physical healing, that's always subsequent to your salvation. It doesn't happen when you're saved. And yet, if this happened with the atonement, then the moment you believe, you should be healed spiritually, and you should be healed physically at the moment of time. That doesn't happen. And the physical healing should not just be of physical diseases, but should be of all of the Adamic curse. You have people who believe that way still wear glasses, still have their teeth filled with things. It's not gold from heaven and things of that nature. So it's a very inconsistent view and has to avoid the context of what it says here. Question? I think the rapture event will be a signal to many that this was the truth and they come to faith. And I'm sure that many of the 144,000 Jews will come to faith because of that. But that itself won't trigger this was national salvation, because national salvation occurs only at the end of tribulation, in the last 3 days before the second coming, according to Hosea chapter 5, verse 15, to chapter 6, verse 3. And so the trigger that will move Israel's national salvation involves the resurrection of two witnesses, Revelation 11, that brings the Jews of Jerusalem to faith to the midpoint of tribulation. And then at the end of tribulation, all Israel is saved. But I think rapture will cause many of the 144,000 Jews to believe. No, you cannot be saved without faith personally in the person of Jesus. And when Jesus said, no man comes to the Father except through me, he was speaking to a Jewish audience at that point, not Gentiles. And when Peter says in Acts chapter 4, verse 12, there is no other name given to heaven to be saved, he was speaking to Jews, not Gentiles. He was even speaking to Orthodox Jews, not secular Jews. So a Jew has to consciously believe in Jesus for salvation. And if they truly believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they'll come to believe in Jesus. Otherwise, they believe in a God that's been redone by rabbinic theology, and that will keep them from salvation. So apart from faith, specifically in the Messiah, there is no salvation for Jew or Gentile. Question? But not called the servant. He's called the servant, but not servant of Jehovah. Proceed. You don't find that title used of Israel. But yes, within Isaiah, the word servant is used in two other ways. Sometimes it's used of Israel as a whole, like in Isaiah 49, 43, verses 9 through 12. It sometimes is used of the remnant of Israel, Jews who believe. It's also used of the Messiah, so the context determines how it's using the word servant. But a title, Son of Jehovah, is exclusively used of the Messiah. My servant, it comes up of the Messiah, but also comes up in Israel, even in unbelief. Question? Yeah. That's true. 80% of Israelis would class themselves as being atheists or agnostics. Only 20% were follow Orthodox Judaism. And their tie to the land is based upon their Jewish identity. It's a nationalistic. Zionism was primarily a nationalistic movement, not a religious movement. That's an accurate expression. It's only true of Israeli Jews, also true of Jews elsewhere in the world. The 80%, even in America here, are quite secular. In fact, there's a story told of a Baptist family that had a son, and then a Jewish family moved next door to them, and they had a son the same age. The two sons became friends. And one day, the Baptist son asked the Jewish son to come to Sunday school with him. The Jewish son asked his parents. The parents were a bit nervous about it, but they were very secular. They didn't want to make religion a big issue. They told the son, okay, you can go this one time. But then we come home, we want you to tell us everything they taught you in case we have to straighten some things out. Well, Sunday came and the two boys went to Sunday school class. When the Jewish son came back, the parents asked him, what did he teach you at that Baptist Sunday school class? And the son says, oh, they taught us about Moses. And the parents will respond, yeah, about Moses? What did they say about Moses? What he told us is this, that when Moses led the Jews out of Egypt, the Egyptian army started to chase them. And so Moses built a pontoon bridge across the Red Sea, and the Jews crossed on the pontoon bridge. And then when the Egyptians tried to follow them on the pontoon bridge, Moses called an airstrike and destroyed the bridge, and the Egyptians were drowned. The Jewish parents said, that's what he taught you at that Baptist Sunday school class? The son says, well, that's not quite the way they put it, but if I told you what they really said, you'd never believe it. And that captures the Jewish community quite well. Question? Yeah. Start again, I'm sorry. Right. Well, it's not the temple's not in use, it's just not there at all. And when temples destroyed in AD 70, they couldn't sacrifice anymore. And so they innovated the substitutions for sacrifice until the temple will someday be rebuilt. And so the main substitute is fasting. On the Day of Atonement, you go through a 26-hour fast of both the dry and liquid products. And the reasoning the rabbis give is that two parts of the animal belong to God alone, the fat and the blood. And by fasting, you reduce your fat, you reduce your blood, and that's a temporary substitute till the temple is rebuilt. And so Orthodox Jews do a 26-hour fast every year in the atonement for that reason. Question? Well, how soon, I wouldn't have a clue, but the Bible clearly teaches that there will be a temple that's going to be rebuilt. The temple building itself has not yet begun because of the Muslims' situation. The Muslims control the interior of the temple compound. But three other things are happening in preparation for it. First of all, there is a group in the Jewish quarter called the Temple Mount Institute, and they're making all of the furnishings for the future temple. When I bring my groups to Israel, I have an appointment with them, and they show them all the stuff they made. They've made their priestly garments and high priestly garments. They've made the lots for the scapegoat, they have the silver trumpets and other things, the pots to catch the blood. Then a second group called the Ateret HaKohanim, it's a Jewish group in the Muslim quarter, And the name of the organization means the crown of the priesthood. And what they've done is pick descendants of Aaron, who are Kohens, and train them to do two proper sacrifices. So when they they're going to try to do proper sacrifices and have people, the temples be built up, people ready to do the proper sacrifices and trained. A third thing that's happening is trying to produce the perfect red heifer. Now, the rules of the red heifer are in Numbers chapter 19, and Moses primarily required a reddish-brown cow. But Rabbi Elul made it more stringent. A cow cannot have more than two black hairs or two white hairs. So 10 years ago, they announced that they had a red heifer, but red heifer is only killed at the age of 3, and by then it had about 10 black hairs and got disqualified. If you see any Hollywood movies, you'll recall that whenever there's a major crisis in the world, you send in the Texas Rangers. In this case, it was a Texas rancher. They had perfect red heifers. He shipped them to Israel, which would you would think would solve the problem, except for another peculiarity of rabbinic law. For the cow to be kosher, it must be born in Israel. It cannot be born in Texas. It must be a Jewish cow. It cannot be a Gentile cow. I guess it must be a Holstein, not an Angus. So what they're doing with those cows you shipped over is to using genetic engineering to try to produce the perfect red heifer. About 2 years ago now, they claim to have found it. We have to wait one more year to see if it's true. So while the temple itself is not yet being built, there are these three things happening in preparation for it. Well, I know about these rumors, and actually three people have already found the Ark of the Covenant. One was in Ethiopia, one was in Jordan, and one was just inside the cave in the Protestant Calvary. They never produced what they claim to have found. I think the assumption people are making is they have to find the Ark of the Covenant for the temple to function. That's not true, because the second temple functioned for 6 centuries with no Ark of the Covenant. We know the Millennium Temple won't have the Ark either, according to Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 16 and 17. I don't think the Ark actually survived the Babylonian destruction, and they couldn't find it after only 70 years. They won't find it after 2,500 years. So I don't think the Ark exists, and you don't need it for the temple to function. We have 6 more minutes. Question? You remember the Thummim was the 12 stones on the breastplate of the high priest. And the Hebrew word means lights and perfections. Light and perfections. It's a way of determining the will of the Lord, but can only respond to yes or no questions. So the question required a yes answer, the stones would light up. If the answer was no, they would not light up. And so it was limited in how much it could communicate. So they have to find out who sinned in Jericho that brought about the defeat of Ai. They first have to parade all the different tribes until one tribe was chosen, then all the clans till one clan was chosen, all the families till one family was chosen, and then all the individuals till one individual was chosen. And then David was able to use it when he was running away from Saul. We always have to ask yes or no questions to it to get the answer. But that's what the Urim and the Thummim was. Yeah. But that's because the Urim and the Thummim was in the high priest ephod. Then when Saul killed all the priests in the city of Nob, one priest escaped and he brought the ephod with him, the high priest ephod. The reason David had access to it was because the priest that escaped, the daughter of Nob, was able to get it. Nob was able to get it to him. That's how he had it. Question? Yeah. Right. David had it, so he couldn't respond to it. And furthermore, the Urim does not have to answer. And in the case of Saul, he quit answering him already.